This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve while he is on a well-deserved trip around the country. We are very privileged this afternoon to have a very special guest with us, Professor Martha Nussbaum, to talk about a new book that she's published entitled Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Professor Nussbaum, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Don. It's good to be there.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's much appreciated.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program.
There are many, many items on your resume, and I think you've probably been through this far too many times, so I'm going to be very sparse and brief and just pick out a few things that I think may be germane to this particular book. I hope you'll appreciate that. Professor Nussbaum received her Ph.D. from Harvard University in 1975 and has taught at Harvard and Brown and Oxford universities. She is now the Ernst Freund Distinguished Service Professor of Law and Ethics at the University of Chicago, and I understand that you have appointments in the philosophy department, the law school, and the divinity school. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just can't resist. Before I go on, just out of curiosity, have you ever had to defend yourself against someone who's asked you how on earth you could associate with the likes of law professors and also be a professor of divinity?
Well, you know, our law school is such a wonderful community for reflecting about ethical and political issues that I don't think anyone who knew the University of Chicago Law School would ask such a question.
Well, do you have to take your halo off when you go from one department to the other?
Well, you know, in the div school, too. I mean, it's a study of religion. It's not being religious. And, I mean, I do belong to a temple, but that's a part of my life that's rather separate from my academic life. And the div school is there study the religion, yeah.
I just couldn't resist. I'm sorry. Professor Nussbaum also is an associate in the classics department and the political science department and a member of the Committee on Southern Asian Studies. You have your feet in so many academic worlds, you've got to be awfully nimble.
Well, you know, the way the U of Chicago works, and it's why I love it, is that I just teach what I teach, and everyone comes from all these different places. So it's possible to do that because we're all on the same calendar, we're all on the same campus, and there's a wonderful spirit of interdisciplinary cooperation. So it doesn't really pull me apart because I just do what I do, and then the different units take an interest in it, or they don't, as the case may be.
I would imagine it's very hard to fall asleep intellectually at the University of Chicago.
Right. It's true.
So we're talking with you today about your latest book, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. And let me also, if I may, mention that I understand that in 2011 you'll be publishing another book entitled Creating Capabilities, The Human Development Approach.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
I gather that this book is, among other projects, a culmination of your work with Amartya Sen.
Culmination. I would say that because I've written two very thick scholarly books about the capabilities approach, for years people have said to me, we want something that we could use in undergraduate interdisciplinary teaching, and your books are too much for specialists. And so it's my attempt to write something, a kind of overview of what's exciting to me about the approach for undergraduates and for the general public.
Yes, this is a short book for those who would be interested in this topic. What is it, about 150 pages? Is that right?
The Capabilities book?
No, the Not-for-Profit.
Oh, Not-for-Profit. Yeah, Not-for-Profit is, I guess, it's small pages, too. So anyway, about 40,000 words is what it is.
It's got to be one of your shorter books.
Yeah, and I made it short deliberately because I wanted it to go to different parts of the country and to different countries, and it's in fact already being translated into about 10 languages, and that's not so common if a book is very long. There just isn't the possibility of translating long books these days.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning of your book it's fair to say the intellectual predecessor of this, or the background or underpinning of it, and that's your 1997 book entitled Cultivating Humanity, A Classical Defense of Reform and Liberal Education. Would that be fair to describe it
that way? Yeah, but, you know, there are a couple of things that have changed now. First of all, this book is much more about the whole world, not only about the U.S. It's picking up on developments that are really pretty general in education around the world. And the U.S. is my special focus, obviously, but in Cultivating Humanity, I was studying the liberal arts system in the U.S. with a very particular focus only on the U.S. The other thing is that I'm talking about schools and universities, not just about higher education, whereas Cultivating Humanity was about higher education.
K through 12 as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so this one takes in K through 12 as well. And the other, the biggest thing that's changed, though, Don, is the times. Back in the middle 90s when I wrote the other book, what I was worried about was the attacks on the humanities that were being made by people who said that the standards are being lowered by people who introduce women's studies, the study of race, and so on. Mm-hmm. And these people wanted to return to a much more conservative form of great books education. But, you know, those people and I had a large area of agreement, which was that the humanities matter, that people should be reading these powerful books from philosophy and literature. And, you know, now I long for those opponents back again, because right now what we're facing is a very widespread contempt for the humanities and a feeling that the reading of philosophy, the study of literature, supplies nothing useful. And use is suddenly the only thing that people are looking for, but meaning by that short-term economic gain. And what I'm trying to say in this new book is I think that's really selling people short. It's selling our democracy short. One of the things that education has always done, both K through 12 and university education, is to build citizens, is to make people who can keep a democracy alive. And the humanities are a huge part of that, because they supply skills of critical thinking and respectful debate. They give people knowledge of the world and its history, and they strengthen and train the imagination, making people much more adequate when they try to imagine what the life of somebody else in their country or in some other part of the world is like. So I think that in selling short the humanities, we're really selling short the future of democracy.
Well, not-for-profit is different, I think, from previous books about the sad state of liberal education and humanities education in this country, in that, you, as you say, you focus on global trends. It is quite remarkable how the antipathy and decline in support for humanities education has gone global. I once remember you, I think you're on UCTV's Conversations with History, if I remember correctly.
Oh, right, yes. No, that was a wonderful interview, yep.
You once made the comment that philosophy is much better received at the public level than it is in the United States, and how you felt so at home, particularly in England, and I think you mentioned also France. But apparently, since even then, there's been a decline. Is that fair to say?
Oh, a tremendous decline. And, you know, what I really felt then, I mean, it wasn't so much England. It was actually Italy and the Nordic countries that were particularly friendly to philosophy, but and India, where I've spent a lot of time. But, no, you know, what I find now is it's so easy for them just to cut it because, I mean, we're lucky because we have an undergraduate liberal arts system. And so when people go to college or university here, they do a major subject, and that's usually going to prepare them for a job. But they also just take it for granted that they're going to be taking other courses in other areas that are not their major subject, because there's this idea of general liberal education that we have. Now, very few countries in the world have ever had that idea. And today, the only other country that really has our liberal arts system in universities is Korea. And they have a very strong commitment to the humanities. In fact, I would say that's the one nation in which the humanities are making gains and not retreating. And I can say something about why that's so if people want to hear it. But anyway, you know, in other areas, in other countries, because humanities are not built into the general required structure of liberal education, it's easy just to cut them away. And philosophy departments are being closed in Britain. All kinds of things are happening that just are very radical, because it's easier to do that. And that's the same thing applies to the schools, because our university system sends a message to the schools. If you want to get into Carleton or you want to get into University of Illinois, you know, this is what you have to do in high school, and then you have to have a broad-based education. But, of course, where you're aiming to study only computer science, let's say, in university, well, then in school you don't have to have a broad-based education. So there's a much greater ease in cutting the humanities outside the U.S. I fear for the U.S. too, but I have to say, at least right now, our strong system of liberal education keeps us from the worst kinds of cuts.
Well, I must say, what is also newsworthy about your chronicle, I guess you'd call it, is this reversal just in so many years. I was startled. I was expecting when I read your book that you would bemoan the lack of intellectual life and cultural stimulation in this country, but you have actually do a reversal and actually describe much of the United States, as you just did in academic terms, as being almost a safe haven, if that can be fair to say. So I found that startling. And I would hope that someone would pick up on what you have to say and chronicle this in more empirical and detailed terms.
Yeah, well, I think what would be good to do would be to make a comparison between public and private universities, for example. I think the U.S., one other reason that we're somewhat safe is that a lot of education is so pluralistic, and it doesn't have any one system of control. So if somebody has the idea in Washington that we should cut the humanities, there's nothing too much that they can do about it, because we have so many centers of control and funding. But I do think that I've seen much more worrying cuts in public universities on the whole than in private universities. And I think, you know, the reason is, again, we have a system that works pretty well. We have a system of private philanthropy where there are strong social norms that reward private philanthropy and strong tax incentives that reward it. And then we do have this system of liberal education, so our future CEOs and our future bankers and so on all go through that. And then very often they remember that as a very happy time in their lives when they were able to just think about ideas, and they loved doing that. And then they come back, and these are the donors that the private universities rely on. Now, public universities, by contrast, rely on politicians, and politicians have different sets of incentives. They have to show next election time that they've generated jobs for their state, and so that's the way they see the state university system. And I think very often they think in short-term ways for that reason. I mean, that's what their incentive structure leads them to do. So I think that, you know, it's interesting that Korea, which is the other healthy case, also has a privately funded system of higher education. At any rate, 70% of the universities in Korea are privately funded. So I'd like to know more about that. You know, I'd like to know the differences that we're seeing. I know a lot anecdotally about large public systems and the cuts they're facing, but I think it would be fun to have a lot more data on that.
Who would have thought the United States and Korea, the last bastions of the humanities?
Well, you know, the Korea case is really interesting, because what I found looking into it, and this is after I wrote the book, so it's not in the book, but I wrote a New Republic column on their online version on that people can look up, which is that during the Japanese occupation, Korean language, Korean literature, and the study of Confucian philosophy were all made illegal by the Japanese. They wanted the Koreans to be low-level techies who just would do their bidding, but any kind of dignified study of their humanistic tradition was actually illegal. But there were illegal schools that sprung up, and so they associate, of course, historically, the humanities with national pride. And the sense that Korea stands for the humanities comes, I think, very much from that period. But anyway, today, you see that not only are the humanities strong, but they're actually getting stronger in the sense that law, which in the United States, you do a liberal arts education before you go to law school. But in most of the world, you don't. It's like you go straight from high school to law school, and therefore law is a rather narrow, not liberally artsy kind of study.
Right.
But in Korea, they've just changed it to be more like the U.S. system, so that now to get into a good law school in Korea, you have to have a liberal arts degree first. So it's interesting that things are moving in a kind of positive pro-humanities direction there.
Now, before we get into the argument in your book, Not for Profit, let me just do two things. Remind our listeners that this is a call-in show, and if you'd like to talk to Professor Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities, please call in locally at 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. One more general question about the book. As I understand it, you are also, among your various items on your resume, on the Committee on Public Philosophy for the American Philosophical Association. Are you chairing that, or are you on the
committee? Well, I was the first chair when they created it. No, my term is over now. But
oh,
anyway,
it is.
I mean, they created this committee because they felt we really need to make contact better with the public, and it's hard to do. So part of the job of the committee was to try to think about ways to do that. And one way, when we put on different workshops on how to write an op-ed, how to make connections with local government and wherever you are, and things like that. So, of course, I'm a public philosopher in a kind of international mode, but we were focusing much more on America. And what can we do to make philosophy a part of daily life in America? Because it's not a part of daily life,
right,
really, and it could be. I mean, in the Netherlands, there's a popular magazine called Philosophy that's really pretty high level, and people buy it, they take it to the beach, and of course they should, because philosophy is fun, and thinking about things like, why are we afraid of death? Is it good to be afraid
right.
of death? What does that make us do? And, you know, all these problems that philosophers have debated for centuries are just fun to discuss, as anyone who teaches it knows. You know, students really come alive and love debating these issues. And so I think we could do much more to bring it into our public culture. But I think what we're facing now is the decline of print journalism and the changes in the media. And it's very hard to keep abreast of that and to try to figure out how to kind of get our voices out there in this changing world.
Well, I asked the question because you are one of, if not our most articulate public defender and advocate for philosophy. I was just wondering if you thought of your book, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities, as a defense of a Socratic public philosophy.
It is. It is. I mean, it's a defense of the idea that we all, as citizens, need to learn the things that philosophy offers, namely arts of critical thinking, arts of respectful debate, where instead of just hurling accusations at your opponent or trying to get out some telling soundbite, you actually listen and you think, well, what is the structure of the argument here? What is this person assuming? Are these assumptions true? Do I share some of these assumptions? And I tell in the book a story of a person I once interviewed who was an undergraduate in a business college, but he was required to take some philosophy classes, which I approve of. And he said it was the first time that he had ever realized that you could actually argue on behalf of a position that you don't hold yourself. Now, this was a very smart young man, but because of the culture of talk radio and so on that we're in, he hadn't realized that very simple thing, that you could actually try to understand the structure of the opposing argument. And he realized this when he was assigned to participate in a classroom debate about the death penalty, and he was assigned to criticize the death penalty, but he actually believes in it. But he learned so much from just thinking about the other side and how you would defend the other side. For one thing, he tried to pinpoint where the disagreement really is and what do the two sides have in common. Well, of course, I think that's what we should be doing all the time in our public life. And we're now in a period of unparalleled hate politics and vituperation. But, boy, in the philosophy classroom, we practice citizenship on a higher plane, and I think we all need the chance to do that.
As November 2nd approaches, I take it you have systematically avoided, if you've gotten any invitations to appear on Fox News.
Like, in general, to appear on news wherever you're cast in a particular mold. And it's very common that they want you to appear as a this or
labeled
a Democrat or whatever. You know, and I wouldn't appear even on McNeil Lehrer if I thought I was being cast as a fan of a particular position.
The token philosopher.
Yeah, if I'm asked to try to understand something, that's when I would want to appear. And of course I have views, but what I'm interested in is the structure of the argument. And I wouldn't want to be on TV unless I was sure that that's what people were interested in.
Now, you open not-for-profit with these rather ominous words that certainly draw the reader in. Quote, we are in the midst of a massive crisis of massive proportions and grave global significance. And you go on to say that you're not talking about the 2008 economic crisis. For our listeners, could you give a brief summary of the scale of this crisis and what it's about?
Well, the crisis is the crisis in education that we've been talking about, where all of a sudden politicians all over the world are trying to refashion education in a way that serves economic growth of that nation. Now, of course, they're all parts of a highly competitive global market, and some nations are trying to grab a larger share of that market, like India, which is a case I talk about a lot in the book. Others are, like the U.S., trying not to lose the share they have, but everyone is competing. And suddenly, and I think this is fueled by the current economic crisis, there's the sense that we got to cut away all useless frills and we have to focus on the things that really generate competitive advantage for our country. Now, you know, it's understandable. I mean, in fact, as I say, politicians have incentives to think this way, but we better tell them that that's not the only way they should be thinking, because something that seems not to generate short-term economic gain might actually be extremely important for the future health of society in the long term. And so that's what I'm trying to say. And I see people talking this way. Of course, in Britain, they've just made these massive cuts. But even before that, they were closing philosophy departments, and they were requiring that every individual researcher should demonstrate, they get 25% of the marks for their research comes from the economic impact of that research.
So now, how is this started before Cameron, you say?
That was before Cameron. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That was the new research excellence framework that was put out last winter. So it was before the book went to press. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the huge cuts are under Cameron, but the spirit is shared, I'm afraid, by both parties, namely that the humanities are useless frills. We want to focus on what generates impact, meaning economic impact. And if you think about some of the world's greatest scholars who have illuminated our life and made us think better, I mean, let's take somebody like the great 20th century philosopher John Rawls, who wrote A Theory of Justice, that whether you agree with it or not, it illuminates the topic of justice in a way that's really one of the great books of philosophy in the last 500 years, I would say. Now, he could not show that he generated short-term economic gain. Mm-hmm. So he would get bad marks in the research excellence framework. And the same would be true of a historian who illuminated something in history. I mean, most of the great scholars of the humanities do not have their eye on short-term economic gain. They have their eye on deeper human illumination, and that's what they don't really respect. So that's one example. I think that every country is different. I actually found, I've just come back from France, and I thought it's only my impression to be sure, but I did talk to some very powerful academic administrators, and I think France is a little bit better off educationally, although, of course, they have massive other problems. Partly because the humanities, as in Korea, are part of national pride and national self-definition. So the way that philosophy figures on the radio, I mean, I was on public radio for over an hour talking about rather detailed things about the relationship between philosophy and literature, and, you know, no program like that would ever exist in the U.S. So I did have the feeling that the public interest in philosophy was stronger in France than it is over here, and certainly much stronger than it is in Britain.
Right.
But, you know, the trends are just going in one direction, I mean, toward cutting, because people are afraid. And they think, oh, well, the thing we have to do to show we're good, responsible politicians is to generate jobs and make sure our economy is growing.
Now, we do have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on line one.
You can't help but separate philosophy from politics, can you? The with the idea that we live in a country that is dominated almost possibly by the doctrine of you got to be afraid. We have early warning systems for this, that, and the other thing, and very bad response time. Why is it that there's no description of how the governors and the wealthy peoples of the country cannot help solve our problems of, I suspect that we are, technically speaking, in worse financial situation than Greece. And we do not have any of our political figures saying, fine, let's have a 25% cut of pay to our politicians. We expect that from our laborers at Caterpillar. Why do we not employ the people that we have devastated by destroying their communities without having them rebuild it? We've refused to have copper allowed to a generator plant in Afghanistan. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, okay, now these are big economic issues, and I'm not an economist,
Is an economic issue.
Hmm?
Being philosophic is an economic issue.
But I think
issue,
the way philosophy comes in is we have to think, what is the goal that we're trying to produce here? Now, actually, there's a big debate about that in economics, of which I'm a part, and this approach that I talked about at the beginning of the program, the capabilities approach, is one that says we should not think of a nation's economic goal simply in terms of gross domestic product per capita. We should think of it in terms of what can people really do? How can they lead meaningful, rich lives? And I've outlined a list of priorities of the things that government ought to enable people to do, which include a wide range of things that education is pertinent to, such as develop their senses, their imagination, their capacities for practical reason. And then, of course, there are other more direct and obvious things, such as bodily health, bodily integrity, the ability to have religious freedom, freedom of speech, and so on. So what I'm saying, and what my collaborators, like the economist Amartya Sen, have been trying to say for years, is that if you keep your mind only on economic growth, you neglect these other crucial aspects of development that are deeply meaningful for people's lives. Because, of course, you can have a lot of economic growth without having the freedom of speech or without having the ability of women to protect their bodily integrity and so on. So you have to think about each separate thing, and you have to have your eye on a bunch of different things and try to enable people across the board. So my thinking about education is closely linked to that approach, and it says that if we have the right conception of the goal that a nation should have, then we naturally would want a broad-based system of education that does train the imagination and the abilities to reason and debate and that preserves our essential freedoms of press and speech and so on. So these two things really do go together. But our country, on the whole, has not taken... I mean, this is an approach in economics, as I say, that I'm a part of, and there's a whole lot of debate about it in various nations of the world. But on the whole, our nation has not taken that approach to heart. It's still focused more on the growth-based model of what it is for a nation to succeed. President Sarkozy of France convened a commission to study this whole question of what the goal of a nation should be. What is it to improve quality of life in a nation? And he included Sen and Joseph Stiglitz and some other people who are thinking about these more insurgent critical approaches, and they came out with an excellent report, which you can find online, which does talk about the enhancement of human capabilities, human empowerment, more broadly conceived. But, you know, that's the exception still, and it's very much an insurgency movement.
The caller does point to, if indirectly, that there is a widespread stereotype, perhaps mostly in the public, that economics is divorced from philosophy, that it's somehow or another just a calculation of rational self-interest. And I take it that that is changing now in the field. Is that right?
Well, of course, economics always had a normative dimension. That is to say, it always... you had to ask, what is it we should be trying to maximize? And some people thought that the answer to that was easy, that it was growth, gross domestic product per capita. Some people thought, again, that it was easy, but they had a different answer, namely that it was the satisfaction of people's existing preferences. But rarely was this question debated with the rigor that it needed to be. And so what Sen and I have been trying to do for years is get people really facing this issue and having the debate. And once you do that, I think it's very hard to think that gross domestic product per capita is an adequate measure of a nation's success. So, of course, we need that partnership across the disciplines, because I can't do the technical work that economists can do, but they're often not really trained to do the kind of work about goals and norms and so on that philosophers are trained to do. So actually, Sen and I have founded an international organization called the Human Development and Capability Association that has annual meetings. We have a journal, and it's all to get young people together. We have 700 members from 80 countries, and we're getting people together to have this talk and to really get things going. But there are other economists who think this way, too, who are not part of our particular association. My colleague, Nobel Prize-winning colleague at Chicago, Jim Heckman, for years has been talking about the capabilities of children in public schools and has been urging early interventions to make sure that imagination and reason and so on are not being cramped by inequality. So there have been these voices for some time, and I think now they're starting to put their heads together, if I could mix a metaphor. Sorry, voices putting their heads together. But anyway, that is happening now.
Is the ghost of Milton Friedman on the wane in the halls of the University of Chicago?
Milton Friedman was a person who loved debate. And actually, I was brought to Chicago in large part through the agency of people who are, in a way, the heirs of Friedman, Richard Posner, Gary Becker, and so on, because they wanted someone to debate with them and to represent the other side. So I just think his approach was not fully adequate, you know, but I think what we want is to show that with arguments, and that's, of course, what we're trying to do. And I had a conference last year that I co-organized with Jim Heckman and the economics department, and it was funded by the Milton Friedman Institute, which, you know, could just shows you that Friedman stood for debate, and that's what his legacy is being used to do.
It really isn't necessary to demonize Milton Friedman, as so many on the left do.
No, I mean, I think you can respect somebody and still think that they were quite wrong. I think Jeremy Bentham was quite wrong, who's an 18th century philosopher who thought that all of human life revolved around the maximization of pleasure. Well, I think that's a wrong view. I criticize it all the time, but that doesn't mean that I don't... I mean, to criticize is already to show respect. You think this person's views are worth spending a lot of your life on, and I do think that about Friedman.
Well, we haven't gotten very far into your argument. Let me try to cut to your discussion of Dewey and Tagore, both of whom you speak very, very highly of. You point out that the influence of both of these individuals is on the wane today, especially in India, apparently. Do you see your own human development model, as you allude to, indirectly, I guess, as an advancement beyond Dewey and Tagore, or a return to these models?
Well, you know, I think in philosophy often advance takes the form of return. Return, let's hope, with superior clarity, because you've now faced down certain opponents that they didn't know about. And so, I mean, Friedman's a good example. So before utilitarianism of that sort was on the scene, you couldn't make the counter argument very precisely because you couldn't even imagine that somebody might see things that way. So I think when you return, and of course I often invoke Aristotle, but I think Aristotle didn't face the problems we're facing, and he also didn't face the intellectual opponents that I'm facing. And so I do feel that I'm resurrecting insights that Dewey and Tagore had. But mm-hmm. now we're in a world where we really have different opponents, and we have to face those opponents. And so we need new arguments. And that's one reason that philosophy never comes to an end, I think.
Right. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment for Professor Nussbaum?
Yeah, hi. I'm calling because I read Eva Federicatte's book on the ethics of caring.
Oh, great. It's wonderful.
And, I mean, the idea that, you know, how the least of us or how the, you know, most, I don't know how you want to say it, disabled or whatever, how we treat those people really tells us who we are, what kind of a society we are. But it just seems that that's the polar opposite of what we've got today, and that unless someone is personally experienced with something like this, there really is no caring whatsoever. So, I mean, it has nothing to do with economic productivity. So I'm going to buy your book, but what, in a short, you know, a few sentences, how can you motivate people who are full of power and money, et cetera, to look at participating in society in a very different way?
Okay, great. I'd love to talk about this. And I should say first that I'm so glad you found that book, because I actually reviewed it in the New York Review of Books because I wanted more people to get to know about that book. And now, by the way, she has a new book, which she edited, called Cognitive Disability and Its Challenge to Moral Philosophy. So I think that's another one that you'd enjoy.
Sure.
In my own book, in 2006, I wrote a book called Frontiers of Justice, where I talk about disability. And what I tried to say there was that it's not just crude politicians, but it's a whole tradition in philosophy that sees society as a bargain for mutual advantage. That's the problem, because that tradition, which is, you know, the social contract tradition, leads us to expect that each person contributes something that makes cooperation profitable. It's got to be, why should we cooperate instead of just not cooperating at all? Why should we get together in society? The idea is, well, each person brings something to the table and each person pays their own way. And if you take that all the way, well, then you think, well, some people don't really pay their own way, and why should we fully include them? They don't bring enough to the table. And I think that's the way we have for so long viewed people with serious disabilities. Now, of course, in many cases, that's just a mistake, and we're underestimating the productive capacity of people with disabilities. So that's one problem. But, you know, in the case of people with severe cognitive disabilities, it's probably true that the expense involved in raising a child with Down syndrome, educating that child to reach his or her full human potential, is well beyond the financial payback that that child is going to ever make to society. But so if you're thinking that way, you will think, what a waste of money to include those children in school and to spend the amount of money that we spend to correct the various medical problems that such children have. And I'm very concerned with different types of cognitive disability, and so I therefore am trying to think, well, what model of society could actually show us why it's important to respect, educate, and value as equals people with very serious cognitive disabilities? And I argue in that book, Frontiers of Justice, that my own capabilities approach does much better there. It shows us a different view of society, that what society is for is about enabling each person to reach their potential, at least on a set, which is not that large. I mean, it's only 10 capabilities, but they're important things. And a decent society, a minimally just society, is going to enable each and every person to get above some reasonable threshold on all these important functions. Now, there are complications. I mean, what if the person is so severely disabled that that person really can't vote? Well, in my article in this new collection that Eva edited, I try to tackle those very difficult questions. But Anyway, there are many difficult further questions, but I think the model of a society that's based on the idea of enabling each person to reach their human potential is one that we actually have, and we have it in our law. I actually wrote something in the Harvard Law Review trying to show that American constitutional law has had this for years, and that we keep talking that language of enabling people to reach their human potential. But we don't put it into practice consistently, and I think that's because we really haven't stated it, and we haven't had that argument out. So that's what I'm trying to do. But, yeah, the case of disability is such a vivid lens through which we see the difference between the growth-oriented model, the profit-oriented model, and my own kind of capabilities, human potential model.
Well, it seems to me also that, I mean, the problem is that when a human being's worth is based on their wage labor, so to speak, I mean, people have dogs and they have cats and they take care of them and they don't produce anything, and yet they would say they've learned a great deal from, you know, taking care of that dog or cat. People take care of small children. I'm just saying that there are also things that we can get from the very care of those people, you know, emphasizing compassion and care and the fact that you can do these things without expecting any kind of reward, so to speak.
Oh, I agree entirely. And I think when you think about why mainstreaming children with disabilities in a public school classroom is such an important thing, well, maybe it makes the class go more slowly in certain areas. And people will often say, well, isn't that a waste of time? No, because you're learning something else that you wouldn't learn in any other way. As you say, you learn not just compassion and caring, but you learn about the diversity of humanity. You learn about some of the things that are going to happen to your own body when you age, because the topic of aging and the topic of disability are obviously in some ways the same topic. You know, some of us will live 30, 40 years with serious disabilities in older age, and that might be longer than the whole life of somebody who was born with a disability. So we have to think of those things together. So you learn about humanity, and that's such a crucial part of education.
I want to thank the caller. We have
thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you
very
for your call.
Much.
We have another caller on line 4. Question or comment for Professor Nussbaum.
Thank you for a very rewarding, informative program. I'm reminded many, many, many years ago of C.P. Snow writing a book, a short one, Two Cultures, you know, between the humanities and science and so forth, which engrossed me tremendously to look into many aspects of what you're talking about, and pursuing it since then. However, I remember a famous quotation of Mahatma Gandhi, "The earth has enough resources for humanity's need, but not mankind's greed." And that's appropriate in a simplistic but overreaching fashion to apply to the situation now as then. And then we have the circumstances where you just spoke about the disabilities physically and such, et cetera. We have the disability of the mind with such illiteracy prevailing through the world, such that those who don't know any better are given to taking actions that consequences of which are thrown to the wind or deliberately inflicted with an eye for an eye for a tooth mentality. So we see the necessity for doing things in different cultures, in different ways that... I remember talking to very briefly to the University of Illinois in Chicago, a professor years ago, and I brought that quotation of Gandhi to him, and I think that he was being paid something like over $250,000 a year, a very, very famous, highly paid professor. And it's, you know, it's some people say, well, where does philosophy lead you? Well, you can certainly become a thinking person, whereas others are so unthinking in doing things and are engrossed in distortions by the media and so forth. So I'm covering a lot of territory. I'd like to give examples, but I look forward to some of your comments.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. Gandhi is one of my heroes, but I have to say that although his critique of greed in some ways was right on target, and obviously I agree, as you can hear, I do think that he went to an extreme. And if you read his correspondence with Nehru is my central hero, let's say, you know, Nehru keeps pointing out that if people are hungry and they're in conditions of poor sanitation and they don't have schools and so on, that's not so good. You shouldn't romanticize poverty. And Gandhi did that sometimes, and he did think that the life in the poor village had a kind of sanctity about it. Well, I'm with Nehru. There's nothing particularly holy about being poor, being hungry, being subject to rape, being subject to all kinds of indignities because you're discriminated against. So, you know, we need public policy to focus on giving people not just a life that's spiritually meaningful, but a life that's decent, a life that's that allows people to have the dignity of being well-fed and well-cared for.
Another comment I wanted to make a long, long time ago, I believe it was the socialist Durkheim commenting about a condition that existed way back just at the dawning of the industrial age. I think the term called anami, a term where the people were not working, not engaged, and they're sort of listless, like we have seen with the huge unemployment throughout the world, and people are in a sort of a vacuum state, not knowing which way to turn, and waiting for the forces of the economy, economic wheels, to get things turning. And you mentioned Korea a while ago. Well, the event that's occurring this weekend is a prevailing of the G20 group that is determining about currency. And there's the old saying, whoever controls the currency controls everything, whether it's in the control, who knows who's going to control it. But so many events are occurring simultaneously that the mind can be bombarded. And in terms of even participating politically, people are turning just to escape vicarious participation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But let me just go back to something you said at the very beginning about the two cultures, because I just want to clarify for everyone who's listening that I am not on the warpath against science at all. In fact, what I deplore affects the sciences too, because the sciences, when they're practiced at their deepest and highest level,
of course,
have a lot in common with the humanities. You know, the interest in rigorous argumentation, testing, but also the imagination, the creativity that's involved. And so there are a lot of cooperations between science and humanities in liberal arts programs around this country, but also in schools. And I think that's as it should be. The school that my daughter went to is a progressive sort of Dewey-ish school, the Cambridge School in Massachusetts. They just built a new science art building to facilitate cooperation between science and arts. And I think that's just right, because what is death is to cut off science from its roots in the imagination and the critical faculties and just practice it as a set of applied routines. But that's as bad for the sciences as it is for the humanities.
Well, I'm really very frustrated that we can't get into all of the things I wanted to ask you about.
Oh, yeah, there's so much. Even though it's a short book, I want to get in that one more time. But it's a very short book. You can read it, I think, with pleasure, and you won't get bogged down.
Well, I have. But let me try out a Socratic question on you. You invite us to do that. You mentioned that the advocates of the economic growth model of education fear the arts, literature, and philosophy. That's a whole topic in and of itself. But let me mention to you that you also claim later in the book that, quote, leading business leaders with whom you have spoken in the United States say that they trace some of our biggest disasters, such as the NASA space shuttle blow up and Enron and the fall of WorldCom, to a culture of yes people, where authority and peer pressure rule the roost and critical ideas were never articulated. Is there some inconsistency between what you have picked up from business leaders and the economic models?
Actually, here? I don't think so. But I think what's fascinating is that the world of business is a world of creativity and imagination. And so I remember when I was teaching at Brown and I was on the committee to select the next president of Brown, and I knew I was going to be meeting these trustees, these business CEOs, and I thought to myself, as a good child of the 60s, or a bad child, as the case might be, oh, now I'm going to meet the military-industrial complex. Mm. But what I found is I'm meeting people of tremendous creativity and imagination and flexibility, who are not dogmatically committed to any one way of doing things, but would just look for the best one. Not the world of development economics or indeed the politics that's associated with that. So when I'm criticizing narrow-mindedness, I'm talking about the old style of development economics, which can be extremely dogmatic, because once you get a certain professional formation, you have a strong interest in not going back and changing, upsetting the foundations of that. Whereas a person in business, you know, there's no such dogma. You do what works, and you look around, and you see what works. So I found, typically, that people in business are far more imaginative and flexible than my standard intellectual opponents are. And
oftentimes more so than academics.
And then academics in general, maybe. Because there's a kind of flexibility built into that. But then, of course, politicians, because I say that politicians have short-term incentives. They got to get reelected next year or the year after, and so they are not really, they're not incentivized to think about the long-term health of democracy. But of course, any good CEO has got to think long-term as well as short-term, because they've got to build a company that's going to last. And so when I worked with people like Tom Watson of IBM on this presidential search, yeah, they knew that it was about a whole lot of different things and that the world was very complicated, and they knew how to think very well about that complexity.
Well, I'm perplexed by this. I understand the point that you're just now making, but I guess I want to pursue it just a little bit more. Do corporate leaders at the level that you've been talking with really want Socratic workers? Many do want their executive and managerial class to think critically and creatively, but isn't that only to the extent that this maximizes the bottom line and
less so about
social justice?
Well, CEOs too, but I think in the long run that kind of dialogue does make a profit. And if I may use just one more example, I happen to know Jeff Smysak, the CEO of the new merged United Continental Airlines, and this has been his practice at Continental. He came in there from a law firm, and he said, I'm going to change the corporate culture, make it much more open, more accountable, encourage dialogue. And Continental rose up from disaster to success, and now he's trying to change the corporate culture that had been there at United as well. And so if you see the little spots that he does on every United flight now, you'll see a guy who's trying to project openness to questioning, because he really wants that, and he's setting up hours when employees can come and ask him questions. And I think that's a healthy corporate culture.
But how far is that openness go? What about the inequity in the pay structure, for example?
Well, you know, I mean, any question can be raised, and I mean, I've had very interesting talks with him, since we both care a lot about the treatment of animals, you know, about what kind of changes in the menu on an airline you can make without being irresponsible as a leader, because, of course, you do have to think of costs. So, you know, all of these ethical issues have to be in the context of trying to build a healthy company that's going to do well, because that's the job. But that doesn't mean that you can't really have open debate, because actually that works much better. When people feel that their voices are heard, they're much happier as employees.
Well, we have about a minute and a half. Let me ask you about your frustration with President Obama and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. Suppose Arne Duncan asked you or said to you, Professor Nussbaum, what you're proposing means spending much more money than we have right now. We barely are able to pay for quantitative testing, for improving math and science scores, and this country desperately needs to upgrade math and science education. Yet you want us to pay for qualitative testing, which you advocate for the humanities. Sorry, we can't do everything. How would you respond to him? And we just have a few seconds left.
Yeah, well, I think the thing is, humanities are actually cheap compared to other subjects. You have to have the people who can teach that, sure, but they don't. The equipment is the human mind, and it's books and words, which by now are not anywhere near comparable to the expense involved in science labs and so on. So I actually think that wouldn't be a very strong answer on his part. Now, the testing thing, I think that's there. It is complicated, but, you know, you've just got to get people to care about it enough that they're willing to go and actually see how the classroom works.
We just have about 10 seconds. Yeah. So sorry.
So I think, you know, really caring about children, you'd figure it out.
Right. It was a privilege and a delight to talk with you, Professor Nussbaum. Thank you for being on our program.
Thank you very much, Don. I really enjoyed it. And thanks to the callers. I really enjoyed your comments.
We've been talking with Professor Martha Nussbaum about her new book, Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Thank you for being with us this afternoon on Keeping the Faith, and see you again next week.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
The holidays are a busy time. Decorating, shopping, traveling to visit with family or friends. WILL is there, too, keeping you informed and entertained as you wind down the year. Your tax-deductible gift right now helps ensure the news and music services you depend on are there for you in 2011. Take a moment now to make your tax-deductible gift online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.